Welcome, welcome, welcome. My name is Jan Desper Peters, and I am your host of the BTST Services podcast, Meeting You Where You Are. We are in some strange times, and I thought that I would open up a little differently today. I'd like to share with you Ella's Song, an a cappella piece written by Dr. Bernice Johnson Reagan and performed by the famous heritage group Sweet Honey and the Rock. Take a listen.
Rest. We cannot be complacent. We may stay alert, stay active, and stay involved.
We who believe in freedom cannot rest. We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
How can you rest?
We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, black mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons. We who believe in freedom cannot rest.
So happy to be able to share this song. This song is an anthem, a meditation on the ultimate lesson of the freedom fight passed down generationally by Miss Ella herself, that is meant to be spoken boldly, out loud, or under one's voice as the situation demands to empower both purpose and resolve. Nothing in this world can bring a message to the soul as quickly and effectively as music. It has been used over centuries to incorporate and to share stories, past and present. Her words set to voice and rhythm are a charge, a call to action, wrapped in the sonorous tones that harkens back as far as slave days and forward to a new generation of equality, fairness, justice, and acceptance for everyone, no matter what their origin. I have two dynamic guests today who believe like me that we who believe in freedom cannot rest until we find it. Joining me today is Mr. Davon Love, and I hope you can hear me, Davon.
Yep, I can hear you. How you doing? Okay.
All right, great, great, great. So, Davon, before you came on, I played Ella's song that was sung by Sweet Honey and the Rock, We Who Believe in Freedom Cannot Rest Until It Comes. And so that was my opener and just kind of like a springboard for us to start having our conversation. But before we do that, Davon, I just want to tell the listeners who you are. So Davon is the Director of Public Policy for Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. For over a decade, he has sharpened his oratory and political analysis skills. He is born and raised in Baltimore, and is a proud graduate of Forest Park High School. That's where he discovered the world of policy debate. After slipping into practice session one day to keep warm before school, Davon was so skilled at policy debate as a high school student, it earned him a scholarship to Towson University. He then gained national attention when he and fellow debater Devin Cooper won the Cross-Examination Debate Association National Championship. That was the first time in history that an all-Black debate team won the tournament. They incorporated hip-hop and poetry and personal experiences that made their presentation so powerful. In 2010, Davon co-founded Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and I'm going to get him to tell us more about that. But in doing that, he gave vision to the mission and signature programmings and the infrastructure of a Black institution. Like other members of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Davon believes that all groups and campaigns that endeavor to fix policies that harm predominantly African-American communities must be led by African-Americans. Davon is also the co-author of a book, Reflections from the Baltimore Grassroots, a collection of essays that describe important issues facing grassroots activists and organizers in Baltimore. Good day to you, Mr. Love.
How you doing? I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. So Davon, today we're going to be talking about two pandemics, COVID-19 and racism. So COVID-19 has that little tag on it, 19, because it's thought to have its onset in 2019, thus the name. But racism has been around for centuries. So I'm just wondering, as a Black man living in an urban setting in America, how are you doing?
I mean, all things considered, you know, I'm doing fine. One of the things that I often reflect about is that there are a lot of people who, you know, have much less to be grateful for than I do. And so I always put that in perspective. You know, even though that, you know, many of us have had to be like cooped up in the house and on, you know, Zoom meetings back to back to back, and, you know, all that. I'm just fortunate that I, you know, that my family's safe, that, you know, I know where my next meal is coming from.
Exactly.
You know, and so, you know, I'm grateful for that. You know, but I think over the next couple of years, at the very least, I think the impacts of the coronavirus are going to kind of be with us. And the question is going to be, you know, what trajectory do we take, you know, as we look to address the things that will be the kind of aftershocks of the pandemic.
Right. I'm also concerned that even though, because I was mentioning this to my husband the other day, that CNN would have a trailer on the side all day long, every day, that showed the number of deaths, the number of new cases, and it stopped appearing. And I'm wondering if that, things like that, not just CNN, but things like that will lull people to a sense of complacency that maybe it's over. You know, we talk about the rollout and the tiered opening of cities and states and businesses, and people still have to understand that there are still, I think yesterday there were 600 new cases of coronavirus, and that we have over 111,000 people who have died. And a large percentage of those that are being hospitalized and that are contracting the virus are Black people. They look like me and you. And so we need to really kind of keep that in perspective, and also just keep up with, you know, all the things that we've been told about sanitation with regard to washing our hands, social distancing, physically distancing is what I prefer to call it, and that kind of thing. So as you're in Baltimore, have you been a part of any of the protests?
I was asked to support one of them that happened last Monday with some young people. But I've mostly been either just supporting or just kind of, you know, watching, you know, from a distance. Just, you know, when things happen in Baltimore, you know, I'm making my business, you know, things like these demonstrations, I'm making my business to kind of keep tabs and jump in where necessary. So, you know, I've certainly been around.
Okay. All right. So tell us a little bit about Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Davon. I know about your work from some work that I've done at other nonprofit organizations. I've always been, I don't even know what the word is, but just like insurmountably impressed with the work and the boldness of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle and all of you that lead that organization and participate. So give us a little information about LBS.
So a lot of us are, as was kind of mentioned in my bio, a lot of us are former high school or college policy debaters. And one of the things that, that you know, we learned from policy debate is that, you know, many of the, you know, white folks that come out of the activity end up working at major public policy institutions. You know, and in fact, there are folks within the activity of debate that take credit for being the kind of intellectual brainchild of the conservative revolution of the late 1960s, 70s, and 80s. You know, and so, and that was really one of the things that, you know, the political left got wrong, you know, post the 1960s, was not building institutions and building institutions specifically for a public policy agenda. So that's relevant because debate continued to kind of serve that role of function. And we were competing against, you know, white folks who, you know, that was the role that they would eventually serve. And so we, when we were done with the activity, just given our success, we wanted to use our skills in a way that would best benefit the community. And so that's why we formed you know, a Black grassroots political think tank with the purpose of kind of being the public policy agenda setting organization for Black people in Baltimore and in the state of Maryland. And so, you know, so we started, our first effort was working on staff with the construction of $104 million juvenile detention facility in East Baltimore. And so that was like a kind of a multi-year effort that culminated in 2003, where we were part of a coalition of organizations that successfully halted the construction of this new juvenile detention facility. You know, so we started on criminal justice related things and then have expanded outward since then. And so, you know, we have a variety of projects that we work on and policy that we work on. And we have a leadership team that has a very horizontal approach to leadership. So mm-hmm. we have a variety of different people in our organization that take on different, you know, parts of the work. And I, you know, I think I'm really proud of the work that we've been able to do since 2010.
I'm glad you brought up the powerful impact that LBS has as it relates to policy. And I was listening to President Barack Obama's town hall, and he said protest creates pressure so that policy can be passed. And real change requires protests to highlight a problem and politics to implement practical solutions. So when we're talking about, because people have so many, there's so much commentary around what's going on in our world right now, especially around the protesting, and then some frame it as riots, and we have discussions about looting. I just want to know your thoughts as it relates to what are the policy implications as it relates to what's going on in our world right now as it relates to racism.
So there are two dynamics that I will highlight. The first is that it's important, I think, you know, for your listeners to know that law enforcement is the providence of state and local law. And the reason, I think former President Obama said that during the talk. And the reason why that's important is because I think a lot of times, particularly when we're watching cable network news, 24-hour news cycle, folks are looking for federal government solutions
right.
to a problem that they don't have the jurisdiction to fix. Right, they can do patterns and practice studies or investigations. You know, they can do civil rights investigations. You know, but in terms of, you know, most of the people who are in state, who are in prisons or in state and local, you know, prison. So the criminal, any criminal justice related item, these are this providence of state and local law. So it requires a whole lot of attention to local and state policy. And so to the point about, you know, protests, you know, leading to policy, you know, I think that's the place where institutions go, powerful institutions go to maintain their power. And so, you know, there's a reason why the Fraternal Order of Police, as a person that, you know, has been in Annapolis for several years doing advocacy, they have a very competent and well-oiled machine as it relates to legislative advocacy.
Absolutely.
Right. And so, you know, so it's important for us that just as much fervor as we have in demonstrations and protests, we got to have on the side of, you know, doing policy work. The other layer.
No, you go ahead, because I have a follow up to that.
And then the other layer is this, is that, you know, one of the things that, you know, I think have been kind of smoothed over. A lot of times when it comes to policy that relates to criminal justice policy that's bad for Black folks, you know, the Republican Party becomes like the target.
Right.
And while much nationally, you know, has Republicans have done that's problematic, we gotta pay attention to the fact that, you know, many of the cities and municipalities where these issues happen, where the policies are insufficient, are Democratic Party majority, right. You know, and so we have to, as Black people, ask ourselves the question, like, how do we hold the Democratic Party accountable, given that, you know, we're essentially a captured electorate within the Democratic Party coalition? And the reason why I bring that up is because the Democrats in Maryland and in Baltimore have mastered the technique of giving the visual or the, you know, appearance mm-hmm. that justice is happening while maintaining the status quo as much as possible. And so I think, you know, in terms of the protests, I think it's very important that our target is precise, and that we don't let like Democratic Party leadership off the hook, because that's how these things have continued to happen, is that they, you know, they're trying to maintain their power, not confront the FOP, not confront the institutions that want things to stay the same. And so I think it's important that we're clear about that.
I think that you raise an excellent point as it relates to holding politicians accountable. I had an interview with Dr. Kevin Washington. I'm not sure you know him, but he's a psychologist and a former president of the Association of Black Psychologists, but just an incredible thinker. And we were talking about politics and we were talking about voting. And specifically, we were talking about President Obama and how some folks, you know, have this debate over whether or not his presidency was effective or was, lent itself toward improving the lives of Black folks while he was in president as the first Black president. And one of the things that Dr. Washington said was that President Obama has said that, you know, I was never asked specifically for something, right? And so Dr. Washington's point is that in holding these politicians accountable, we have to remember that we put them in office. They are responsible for an agenda that ensures that we have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as Americans, and that we have to create an agenda to be very specific about what it is we expect from them, that we have to create this environment of expectation. And so as Baltimore, the city that you live in, the city that I work in primarily, is on this journey toward getting a new mayor. And last I looked, I don't know where the tally was. It was so close that they were still trying to get absentee ballots and that kind of thing in. What would LBS or even our community, what should we be asking of this new mayor?
So I actually want to say a couple of things about the piece around Barack Obama for a second, because I think it'll help answer the question about what we asked the mayor for.
Okay.
So there are two sides to the coin there. On one hand, whenever a person is voting for supporting a person for public office, a lot of times it gets reduced to the individual personality. And one of the things that we attempt to tell people is that people who are running for public office are extensions of institutions. Mm-hmm. They have a particular set of interests. And so the question that, so for me, there are three questions that are always important to ask about a person running for public office. One is, you know, who trained them, right? What is their training and socialization? You know, the second is, you know, what institutions stand to benefit if they are elected to public office, right? And three, where's the money come from, right? And those things are more important than whatever a candidate says out of their mouth, right? And the reason why that's important is because if we look at and, you know, take these questions and apply them to former President Obama, then, you know, I think what is made clear is that our community collectively did not play a huge hand of putting him in office, except for the fact that we voted for him in huge numbers, right? And so to the point about the fact that he was, that, you know, one of the things he said was that, you know, he wasn't asked for anything specific, a part of the issue, and now this is where it comes on us, is that we as a community have not done the, what I call the unglorious, unsexy work of building an independent Black political infrastructure that people in public office fear, right? And so in many respects, the best that Black people get electorally is folks pandering to us, right? People doing symbolic and cosmetic things to get our vote as opposed to delivering on policy. And so to your question about what does that mean that we ask for of a new mayor, you know, to me, what that means is that we need to begin to build the infrastructure so that whatever demand that would be made, that we have the political power to be able to deliver on those demands. And I think, and if we think about Baltimore, you know, and you get clear, you know, there's some clarity about like where the power comes from, you know, Greater Baltimore Committee, right? Mm-hmm. The corporate, the center of white corporate power, you know, in Baltimore. You think about a lot of the major developers and, you know, and so I say all that to say that I would argue that aside from any particular issue to focus on, we got to build that infrastructure. And other folks have it, like other, you know, communities have it. We got to build that independent political infrastructure so that we're even a threat, so that we're even a group of people from whom people fear political consequences in the way they fear that from other groups.
I'm going to ask you to drill down a little bit on that for me, Davon, as it relates to how you do that. I hear what you're saying, and I know that when in the work that I've done in the community through various Black organizations, I've tried to move my organization and move the agenda away from, you know, we understand what the problem is. So what's the solution? What are the steps that you would suggest that we get, that we implement? Because, you know, my concern, to be quite honest with you, is that in so many instances, we have a situation in our Black communities. And then we, you know, kind of know what the issue is. We don't know how to get, we don't know what the steps are to get to the solution. And then the white folks come in with their solution, with their curriculum, with their evidence-based practice. They get the funding. And then they implement that in our community to tell us how we gonna help you all out. And so I'm trying to move away from that paradigm.
So I would say a few things, and a lot of it's simple, just hard work. The first is that I think we need to develop a culture of investing in producing political candidates. So a lot of times what happens is, you know, if I decide I want to run for office, you know, I might go to, you know, an NAACP fundraiser, or, you know, I might go to, you know, the thing with Black contractors, you know, but in terms of like an overall system where we're producing candidates, that's not something that we intentionally do. So I think one piece is building, you know, programs that specifically for the purpose of Black folks to produce, you know, and think long-term. It's not just like, you know, a year, 2 years out. I mean, people who show interest early on to be able to build a pipeline, an organization that can be a pipeline to produce candidates. And then our community collectively funding it, right? So that it's not controlled by other folks, but that we're funding it. And so that goes into a practice of, you know, the same way that we might, you know, buy Netflix or Hulu or whatever it is, you know, give a few dollars, you know, to entities like that on a regular basis so that they can be sustainable. You know, so that's one example. The other is also, you know, and in addition to this kind of, this idea of building a pipeline, also, you know, building environments where folks have to come before our community, right, in order to, you know, run for public office as almost playing defense against others. And a great example of this, you know, when you look at, for instance, Victorine Adams, she was the first Black woman elected to city council in Baltimore City. And one of the things that she was very well known for is the development of colored women's democratic clubs. Mm-hmm. And when you see pictures of some of their meetings, and we're talking like this is the 1960s and 70s, you see big crowds of Black people and then political officials on the front, you know, speaking to them about, you know, and being asked questions and grilled by them about what their agenda is. So to me, that model is important. It's having some kind of infrastructure where people in elected office know if you want to get elected, you got to come through here.
Right.
You know, and build that kind of machinery, such that that's the expectation. So, and then I guess I would say the third piece is that we have to build, you know, some organizations have political action committees. You know, or some communities rather have political action committees or have multiple. But we need, I think, here in Baltimore, you know, a independent financial source of resources, you know, capital, you know, that can do the work, not just of supporting particular candidates, but do the work of supporting all the things that are needed for political activity. Mm-hmm. You know, so whether that's like, you know, building a database of volunteers, you know, whether that's like a map of all the kind of, you know, community assets, you know, around the city of Baltimore. But there needs to be some independent entity with the finances to be able to fund these different parts of the work. So those are things I would say are like the start of kind of building that independent Black machinery. And again, you know, other communities have it. Like, and I'll give one example. I think it's one I use a lot. I think it's a good one. A few years ago, there was some attempts to deal with the fact that there were too many liquor stores in Baltimore City, like mm-hmm. to deal with the density of liquor stores. And so a part of what was demanded and put forward was a change in the zoning and licensure of liquor stores. So that the idea was you shouldn't have more than one within 100-foot radius, or, you know, something to that effect. And I remember the Korean Merchants Association got involved, right, and pushed back.
Right.
Because many of them were the owners of a lot of those establishments, mm-hmm. right? And so they pushed back. And they were able, in many respects, to be successful in watering down, you know, what the intent of the legislation was, right? And that's an example where our interests directly clashed. But because they had the organization and infrastructure
and money,
you know, they were right. they were able to, you know, so that's what my point is. That's what we need. We need the ability to be able to marshal those level of resources and level of infrastructure so that in instances like that, we can flex that same kind of muscle.
I have a good friend, and you know him, Richard Rowe, and we've had these conversations before as it relates to Black people funding, you know, Black efforts, Black organizations. And the same way, as you said, that they may buy some stock in Netflix or Hulu, that they then also even, you know, be a contributor to LBS, be mm-hmm. a member of the Blacks and Wax Museum or the Reginald Lewis Museum. And so it's a mindset, you know, it's a paradigm shift. It's a way of thinking where we have to just kind of drill down in ourselves and others that nobody's coming to save us. Like mm-hmm. we need to change the way that we do business as well as expect the way that other people are doing business has changed, which kind of leads me to my next question in relationship to, and I don't know if you've gotten these, but the first one I got, I was a little taken aback where a white colleague sent me a note basically saying that they were very sad about the recent events, and if there was anything that I thought that they could do, please share that with them, and also that they wanted to have a conversation with me because they were open to learning and understanding, because he understood that as a white male he had certain privileges and could never really understand the plight of Black people, but Black men in general. And so I was thinking about that, and then immediately what came to mind was the conversations that Malcolm X had around allies. And I was wondering what your thoughts were around, because when you look at the protests, they are flooded with young white people who are protesting, which we probably haven't seen in the history of protesting. We probably haven't seen this number of allies in that space. And so just wondering what your observations are, what your thinking is, and what we should be saying to them.
Yeah, there's a lot there. actually, and it's interesting. I actually just wrote a piece that LBS is going to publish probably next week or so that deal with a lot of this. So a couple layers to that. The first is So one thing I think is important that I've seen happen is I've seen people attribute some of the more confrontational behavior with law enforcement to the influx of white people at protests. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've made it a point to tell people is that while a lot of that may be true, and I've seen it, you know, I've seen white folks go to the front, you know, do crazy stuff. It's important that we not overstate that narrative because it becomes a justification for potential military intervention. Mm-hmm. In ways that, because our people are doing some of that too. And I don't know, there was a op-ed in the New York Times, and now they're trying to backtrack on from Senator Tom Cotton that was entitled "Sending the Troops." Mm-hmm. You know, so that's one kind of small piece or smaller piece. So in terms of, you know, when white folks ask what they should do, I think we should be clear that we live in a society structured on racism and white supremacy, right? And I'm a believer of what Derrick Bell has said about the existence of racism in America, that America is not a mistake, or racism is not a mistake of America. But racism is a permanent part that is part and parcel of what America is. And if we're clear about that, then when we talk about the kind of changes that are needed, we're talking about fundamental shifts in power. And those fundamental shifts in power, when you really get to what they mean, you're talking about people's livelihoods, and you're talking about people's ability to accumulate wealth.
Right.
And what I often try to tell Black folks, particularly like younger Black folks, who some of them can be, you know, swayed or coaxed into thinking that these white people are so different than the ones in the past,
right?
You know, and we try to tell them that if you know history, you know that, you know, this is not unique. White folks acknowledge, you know, what can we do? White folks have been doing that.
Right. They were on the Freedom Rides too and sitting at the lunch counters too. Absolutely.
Exactly. Exactly. and so the thing that, where they show their whiteness is when they start having to have the things that they're entitled to be ripped away from them. And so to me, that is the ultimate, that is really the test as far as I'm concerned, which is what is their willingness to challenge institutions that perpetuate white supremacy in such a way that it would potentially undermine their own livelihood.
Mm.
Right. And that's a line that most white folks won't cross. But to me, that's the line that if you're serious, and that's all I care about. I don't care about the, you know, throw a couple extra dollars at a thing or, you know, put up a statement we're in solidarity with me. I don't care about any of that stuff. I care about, you know, will you go to the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge and say to them that we're going to advocate that all the people that give you money should stop giving you money. Mm. And we're going to support decertifying you as a collective bargaining unit. You know, like, go there in ways, because those are the kind of things that people get real ugly, you know, over that stuff. Because that's what a power is. So I would say, so that's one part of it, you know, to white folks, which is just being clear. Mm-hmm. And all white people ain't, you know, they're not trying to go there. You know what I'm saying? And I think it's important for us to be clear about that. And then the last thing I would say, and this actually relates to what I mentioned earlier that I've written about, you know, there's a thing that has happened, and we're calling it like the continued colonization of what's called radical politics.
Mm-hmm.
So what white folks like that do, because there are a lot of white folks who kind of express the sentiments that you described, and they're either powerful people at universities or nonprofit or within philanthropy or the media. And the thing about white folks like that, just to be frank, is that most of what they know about Black people is the sociology of our suffering, mm-hmm. right? But they're not clear about the actual depth of our tradition of, you know, fighting for our community.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of time, see, white folks have this real kind of sadomasochistic relationship to conversations about racism, right? The liberal ones. You know, they'll sit in a meeting and hear people talk about, like, how racist they are and how bad they are. They almost get some kind of sick pleasure from it. It reminds me of a conversation that one of Malcolm X's aides, Earl Grant,
mm-hmm.
he had one of the things that he had said to Malcolm, where he said, you know, they'll pay you all kinds of honorarium to talk about the white man's the devil and all that stuff. You know, they're fine with that. He said where Malcolm became a threat was when he started explaining to people how government works.
Mm.
right? When he started explaining, like, 16 out of the 20 House committees within the U.S. House of Representatives were chaired by Southern segregationists, you know, and 12 of the 16 senatorial committees. When he started breaking that stuff down, that's when he became a threat. Mm-hmm. White folks in those, white liberals in those high positions, in many respects, because of their sadomasochistic and paternalistic relationship to Black people, they, in many times, elevate Black folks who are able to present rhetoric and activity that is disruptive, mm-hmm. but that doesn't actually challenge or change the power arrangement. Mm-hmm. And so the increased presence of white people, it creates an environment where you have some of us who will you know, be the people that get a lot of the airtime, right? Particularly nationally, who can sound radical and talk about institutional racism very articulately, but aren't building the power base to shift the arrangement of power such that Black people collectively have more power to make these institutions behave differently.
Right.
And so my concern is that you have this influx of white folks being concerned. It puts them in a much greater position to be the ones curating which Black voices are put to the fore and which ones are marginalized. And so I think it's incumbent upon us that even as we recognize that the gesture of white folks wanting to be more involved and being more present at these protests, that we're not too congratulatory mm-hmm. about their presence. That, you know what I mean? And that there are also some potential dangers to their presence if we're not careful.
Okay. All right. So Devon, before I let you go, I really would like for you to speak to, I mean, I see, and I'm going to try to remember this quote, the person I spoke about earlier, Ella Baker, who was a staunch civil rights activist that didn't get her just due because she was in a very paternalistic environment as well, even among mm-hmm. Black males. And that's right. She said throughout her life in her grassroots leadership, strong people don't need strong leaders. And right. and basically, you know, not really as some kind of disparaging remark against, you know, the Martin Luther King Juniors of the world, but she really meant that, you know, we have strength and determination in ordinary people. And so as mm-hmm. we see so many young people out here on the front line, I'd just like for you to share, as a leader and as an organization that is a staunch advocate for leadership of young people, of Black people, what would some advice you'd give to them? Because I've even heard people say, well, where are our leaders? You know, why aren't they out here? And I'm thinking to myself, you're a leader. mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd like for you to share any thoughts you have about that.
Yeah. So it actually dovetails nicely with what I was saying a moment ago, which is that I think that one of the impacts of white supremacy is that it has created this phenomenon of what Dr. John Heber Clark refers to as ego starvation, right? So, you know, we get beat up all the time in the media and popular culture, you know, you're not smart, you're inherently criminal. And so a lot of times our people are looking for ways to affirm our worth through the things we do. Mm-hmm. And as a result, to your point, it creates a dynamic where because of the kind of injected oppression that caused us to believe in these notions of internalized inferiority, we then expect other people to do for us what we should do for ourselves and what we should see as a collective effort. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would say one, it's really important, I think, for people to deal with some of the psychological damage that white supremacy has done to us collectively that would make us say things like, where are our leaders, or what are people doing for our community? Because anyone that understands our history knows that we're constantly doing things for our community, right? And that we may not see it, but that it's happening. And have enough belief in our community to know that that's happening. And so, and then reframing the question to say, well, what can I do to help support the work that's being done, mm-hmm. you know, to empower our community? And then the second thing I would say, this sounds really simple and it's become something that is like, it's just becoming increasingly important. I think it's very important for people to, we got to read history. We got to read and know history. You know, I mean, even using Ella Baker as an example, I mean, and reading history, not just to like know what happened, but to study it. You know, I find Ella Baker's career instructive in the sense that, I mean, even the clash she had with the NAACP, right? Where, you know, she was responsible for helping organize the branches. And the national, all the national wanted was the branches to give their money to fund VC lobbyists. Mm-hmm. Ella Baker wanted to use the branches as power bases to pressure elected officials in the government to do something.
Right.
And national felt like that would threaten their relationships. That would get too out of control. It would impact their relationships. And I think Ella Baker's stance in that was the correct one. And I think history proves, you know, it proves that her perspective on that was correct. Because I think a lot of the problems that we have as a community with our leadership have to do with folks like the NAACP leadership during her time there, for whom that was their primary approach to change, as opposed to building up the community's capacity to put pressure on the institutions of our society to make change. And so I just think it's important for our community. We got to study and read and know this history so that we actually have an ability to read what's happening and be able to respond to it armed with the knowledge of what has happened before. And I just think, you know, like I've seen some memes and shirts that say something like, you know, we are not our ancestors. We will F you up. You know, and it's like, yeah, they don't know their history.
right.
They don't know better. You know what I mean? And I just think it's important. I think, and it can feel academic. It can, you know, it's, again, it's not cool and all that, but I just think that's so essential. We gotta read and know and study our history.
Devon, I really appreciate the time, and I really appreciate you agreeing to do this. When I was thinking about, you know, whose voice I wanted to have in this space, yours was right at the top of the list. And so I want to thank you for your time today. I just want to echo your sentiment around people knowing their history. And, you know, just like when people say, well, if I were a slave, I wouldn't have taken, it's like, you know, dude.
They don't know that.
Sister, you need to understand your history and you need to read. And people just don't want to do that anymore. They don't want to study. So it's reading and studying to know your history. Because as the saying goes, if you do not know your history, then you are doomed to repeat it. And so we really need to circle back to that and incorporate that into any community-based programming that we're doing. The history, reading and studying your history is important. So again, thank you, Devon. You've been listening to the Meeting You Where You Are podcast, sponsored by BTST Services. And my special guest was Devon Love at Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Devon, would you share with us your website so people can get more information?
So we're at lbsbaltimore.com and then lbsbaltimore for all your relevant social media.
Okay, great. And so like and share and subscribe to this podcast, Meeting You Where You Are, on Podomatic, SoundCloud, and the Apple Podcast app. Until we meet again, stay safe, stay healthy, and remember, no justice, no peace.